Okay, let's get started. Okay, obviously the source of our halacha comes from the Gemara in Brachos, quotes a Braisa that says, Ana Rabbanan, the Braisa describes, HaRoachama v'tkufa sa, if you see the sun in its tekufa, Levana v'gvorasa, Kochavim v'mesilosam, Azalos kesedran, other astronomical phenomena, Omer Barachos de Breshis, the Emas heavy, the Gemara asks, when does this happen? Amar Abaye, Abaye, the Gemara says, Chalester Mishmona Shnin. Every 28 years, the Hadar Machzar, when the cycle repeats, the Naflat Kufas Nisan, the Shapsai, the Orthodox Las Nagi Arva, as Rabbi Reis described earlier. What exactly is a Tkufa? A Tkufa refers to either a cycle, a season, or a time period. Such as Tkufas Nisan. Tkufas Nisan very specifically refers to the vernal or the spring equinox. We'll describe all of these as we go on. So essentially Abaye's explanation is Kol Esrim Ushmon Ashnin, every 28 years, V'hadar Machzor, when the cycle starts over, D'nafla Tkufas Nisan, and the vernal equinox falls, V'shapsai, on Saturn, the Orta de Tzlas Nagi Arva, on Tuesday evening, which is the evening of the third of the evening going into the Yom Revi'i of Wednesday. For now, let's ignore the reference to Saturn after all. That is an astrological reference rather than an astronomical reference. Besides, it isn't really essential for understanding the other points. If anybody is very curious about it, we can talk at it later. When the vernal equinox falls at the same time as it did at creation, is the spirit of what's happening, we say the bracha. So of course our first question is, what is an equinox? Many of you know that the day of the equinox, which happens to be, is coming up this week, refers to a time when the word equinox means essentially equal nights. Equal nights, either meaning that the nights are equal to the days, the length of the day, the daytime 12 hours equals the nighttime period of 12 hours, the world over, roughly the world over. Or perhaps it also means that the nights are equal everywhere around the world, they're 12 hours, as opposed to other times of the year when the nights in one part of the world are longer than other parts of the world are shorter. But what we are going to be dealing with is not so much the day of the equinox, more of the moment of the equinox. What's the vernal equinox specifically? What time does that occur? And how do we know that this year is the right one for the bracha? And what date during the year should we say? These are questions we'll deal with in the course of this morning's discussion. And what's most important, I believe, is a kind of a familiarity with the astronomy that the people from so many years ago that predate the telescope and predate, for that matter, clocks, accurate timepieces, which are essential for accurate astronomy, before clocks, before telescopes, people were doing what's called naked eye astronomy or stargazing. And that, we assume that the people back then were familiar with the astronomy. The most significant point that early people became familiar with was that when you look up at the sky and you don't have all of the light pollution that we have nowadays, and you actually would be able to see something, and you'd be able to see the stars, and when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu, Svara kochavim im tuchal l'sparosam, clearly there were a lot. If we went out, so let's say any night, and we went out and somebody asked us, go and count the stars, we could do that in about 4 or 5 minutes. We'd only need to count all the way up to about 9 or 10, and we'd be done, and we would be unimpressed by that kind of a promise, because we really can't see so many stars. You have to go to a very, very dark place. Recently I noticed that the National Geographic had a whole article on trying to identify places on the globe where you have very dark conditions that are suitable for stargazing. There are not so many right now in the world. But in any case, if you could imagine a time before all of the artificial lighting, when the nighttime was very dark, when you're able to see when the atmosphere was less polluted and less cloudy and less dusty, when it was a clearer vision, there were several thousand stars that people would be able to make out by naked eye alone. And what would strike us, I believe, is that it just looked like somebody sprayed a lot of powder up on the sky. And what they discovered very early on is that the stars, the powdering of the stars, were all actually in the same positions from night to night and year to year. That's the first significant astronomical point that we need to be aware of. Second is that it's very obvious that some stars shine a lot brighter than other stars. Some are very dim, some are extremely bright. And by paying attention to the bright stars, people were able to notice their positions from night to night. And that's how it became clear that the stars were, in general, in the same spots from night to night. Now, the brighter stars suggested to people, in a way of trying to imagine, the same way that people like to do with cloud shapes, what shapes can you see in the clouds? People do the same kind of thing for the stars. What shapes can you find in the star clusters, in the pattern of the stars? And the ancients came up with up to about 50 star patterns or so, called constellations. Now, what's interesting is that in studying all of these stars, people began to notice that while almost all of the stars stay in the same spots, there are a few that move. There are a few of these dots that drift. There are five of the brightest stars that move. They don't stay in the same spot. It's only all the others that are stuck in the same place. Those five stars, those five dots, from our perspective, you have to remember, stars are just dots. They just move, but they don't move all around the sky. If you were able to watch very carefully from night to night, from month to month, year to year, and for that matter, lifetime to lifetime, what you would be noticing is that these moving dots move along virtually identical paths in the sky as if on a fixed track. That's called the ecliptic. That's the path of these roving dots, these moving stars. Those wandering stars were called at that time, and what are called now, the planets. Now, interestingly, the sun and the moon follow exactly the same tracks. Now, what I mean when I describe that is that we all know that in the course of a day, the sun rises in the east, crosses the sky, it sets in the west, but it's carrying the whole sky along with it. And so that's not the motion that I'm paying attention to. I'm paying attention to a different thing, which is that when we have the backdrop of all the stars in the sky, and we have these few stars that move against the backdrop of the stars, which means that some days that particular star will be kind of lined up against this particular constellation of stars. And other days it'll be against a different constellation of stars. It happens to be that the sun and the moon do that as well. And they were also viewed at that time as planets. They weren't obviously viewed the same way. They were viewed as planets in the sense that they wandered about the stars, meaning that you could sometimes look up in the sky and notice that the moon is against those stars over there, and then the next night it'll be against a different group of stars. So it'll move against the backdrop of the stars. The sun does that also. You can't really observe that while the sun is up in the sky, so that has to be inferred. There are several ways that you could infer that. One way is by paying attention to what happens at midnight. At midnight, you're able to see some of the stars, and then in the course of the year, it's a different set of stars that you're able to see. And if you become familiar with the layout of the stars, you could calculate that the sun has obviously drifted around the sky into different positions. And so you can infer that the sun has drifted against the backdrop of the stars. Those seven planets that were known to the Chazal and to the Umos HaOlam also, are, of course, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and of course, the Sun and the Moon. Naturally, remember, until modern times, nobody knew of the existence of Uranus, Neptune, the asteroids, the numerous miscellaneous bodies that are part of our solar system, because those are not visible to the naked eye. In any case, as I say, you couldn't detect them unless you had a telescope. Now, paying attention to this track of the path of these wandering stars, the planets, and the Sun and the Moon, the track has the following path. It slopes upward, which is northward, then downward, then repeats, all at different intervals. The period of the different stars are different. The position of the Sun, of course, was the most carefully noticed. People would would spend inordinate amounts of time trying to figure out exactly where the Sun is against the stars. That, of course, led to so much of astrology was which stars is the Sun in right now, and when you were born, and other kinds of events. Now, it happens to be a careful study of the Sun would reveal that it takes exactly a year to make a full circuit around the sky. The track of these planets, and all of the planets, passes through 12 significant star shapes, the star constellations that are the famous ones that we know of as the zodiac. The zodiac really represents 12 of the numerous constellations, the ones that are significant because they're the ones through which the track of all of the planets pass. The midpoints between the highest spot on the ecliptic of the path of the all of the planets, including the Sun, and the lowest spots, that's on the what's called the celestial equator. We'll see all this in a little bit. When the Sun is actually on the celestial equator, which means when it's midway in its northward or southward path, when it's midway from north to south or south to north, when it's on the celestial equator itself, that is the moment of the equinox. And it's in a single moment of time when it does that, because it's constantly moving, slowly, but nevertheless moving. We're going to take a look at a star map, and let me ask you just not to advance yet. We're going to take a look at a star map, courtesy of MoonCalc 6.0, written by Dr. Munzer Ahmed, and this is a bit of freeware you could download off the web. Okay, we're looking here at actually current conditions, current meaning as of this morning. This is a map of the sky. Let me describe some of the features, how to use a map of this type. You'll notice that it's possible to give reference lines to the stars in the same way that we have latitude and longitude on the Earth. There's also a celestial latitude and longitude as well, not with the same names. The celestial latitude is called declination. And the system of putting the reference lines on the sky is exactly parallel to what we have on the Earth as follows. If we could imagine, let's imagine this is what it appears like to us, is that we're standing here on the Earth and we look up at the sky and what we see is a giant sphere of dots that surrounds us, and that although in fact we know that these stars are distributed throughout the sky, we could imagine that there's a solid sphere around us with the dots in it, and that we will call the celestial sphere. And if we could imagine, let's say, that the north pole of the Earth projects all the way up into that sky, and the south pole goes down into the south part of that celestial sphere, we would then have the the earth, the terrestrial equator, would spread out and also cut across the sky at the celestial equator, that would give us our references for latitudes, for longitudes, and we would then be able to identify, you see on the right side I have over here, a declination measure, and in the middle it says zero. Declination is measured in positive degrees and negative degrees, representing north and south. And at zero, which is the celestial equator, we have all of those particular stars that would be directly overhead for somebody standing on the equator and looking straight up in the course of a day. They would be able to see all of those stars passing directly overhead. Where we are, we're at about 40 degrees north latitude or so. So we would be, if you look all the way up toward the top, at the 40 line, those are the stars that if we look directly up right over our head at the zenith, then we would, in the course of a day, see all those stars. The fact that half of the day the sun is in the sky washing out all the stars, we can't see them, isn't the point. But they would be there. Now what's very important is that, well, in this particular star map, he identifies some of the brightest stars. What's important is that, although it may be hard for you to see this, I'll try to indicate this as best as I can here, there is a red dashed, a little bit of a sinusoidal curve that starts at the zero point on the right, and it goes upward, and then it curves downward, and then it curves back upward again to the other end of the star map. And that dashed red path represents the path of the ecliptic, the path of the stars.
That starts here, and it curves up, comes back down here, and then it goes up here.
Now that represents the path of the planets and sun and moon through the ecliptic. It happens to be also that this particular program demonstrates the moon's position, the sun's position, and the various planets. And you can see that the planets are right along the path of the ecliptic as well. The ecliptic itself exactly is the sun's path, and the others are just very slightly, possibly a little bit north or south of the ecliptic. Okay, now what we need to pay attention to is this. The path carries the sun and all the planets as far north as a little over 23 degrees or so, and then farther down, as far south as about negative 23 degrees or so, and then the way this map is drawn, it ends right in the middle at a zero declination. This represents the path of the sun through the course of exactly 1 year. Now that means that at different times of the year, the sun can be found at different locations. When it's directly at this most northerly point, When it's done, its travels as broad as far north as it will ever get. That we call the summer solstice. That's when the sun has stopped. Solstice comes from where the sun stops in its northern path, and then it turns and goes down. That could also be one of the meanings of the term tkufa, which may relate to the word turning, which is where the sun turns from a northern path to go more southerly. At the bottom of its path, where it's most southerly, it's going to happen in the winter solstice, which is approximately December 21st, when the sun is lowest in the sky. And then we have these other points along the middle when the sun is located right on the celestial equator, and that happens at two points. One point is when it's going northward, and one point is when it's going southward. When it's going northward, that is the moment of vernal equinox, when it crosses the celestial equator on its northward path. And then half a year later, when it crosses the celestial equator on its southward path, it's the autumnal equinox. And just for your own information, the constellations can be identified. Okay, I blanked out some of the stars here, so it'll be easier to spot that there are constellation markings here that you can, well, if you were standing where I'm standing, you'd be able to read the names of the different constellations that run past the ecliptic, and the ones that are significant for our purposes, that up toward the top there of the path you see Cancer, the one toward the bottom you see Capricorn, and then those are significant because the fact that Cancer is all the way at the approximately where the sun hits its northernmost point on the celestial path, it's actually going to be right above a place 23.5 degrees of north latitude on the Earth, which is why that's designated on globes as being the tropic, which is the turning point of Cancer. And then 23 degrees south latitude is designated as the tropic of Capricorn for the same reason. It's that the sun is in Capricorn at the time when it is doing its tropicking, its turning. And that's, for our purposes, we don't care too much about that. What we care about is this. It's that when the sun, you'll notice that the sun is actually drawn as being just about at the point of hitting back to the equator, which is an indication that the sun is just a few days away from being at the point of equinox. Okay, as another way to demonstrate this, we're imagining the celestial sphere as being a sphere that is concentric around the globe of the Earth. We're imagining that the terrestrial North Pole goes right into the celestial North Pole. The equator of the Earth projects onto the celestial sphere as the celestial equator. And you can notice what's in yellow marked as the ecliptic matches what we're describing before as being therefore the apparent path of the sun northward for half the year and then southward for half the year. Okay, now our question becomes exactly how long does it take for the sun to make this circuit? How long exactly is a year? For purposes of halacha, we hold a year is 365 1/4 days exactly, as Rabbi Reis mentioned earlier, which is, and this is just a simple mathematical calculation anybody can do on their own, 365 days, 6 hours, which is 52 weeks, and 1 day, and 6 hours. The reason that it's helpful to view the year in that way is you'll see in a moment. So, for example, last year, March 15th of 2008, was a Shabbos. Now, exactly 1 year later, March 15th of 2009, which is today, is a Sunday. Now, why is it significant that it's 1 day of the week later? It's because the 52 weeks plus 1 day means that the same date this year is going to be 52 weeks and 1 day later than last year. So if last year that date was Shabbos, this year Sunday, next year Monday, and 2 years from now, March 15th, will be on a Tuesday. However, because the year is not 52 weeks and 1 day exactly, but it's 52 weeks and a day and a quarter, we can't lose that quarter of a day every 4 years. We need to take that day into account, and so we add a leap day. And that's why in the year 2012, March 15th, we'll actually skip a day and be the following day. Okay, this reflects the view of the first generation Amora named Shmuel, which is accepted as authoritative, despite recent measurements that reveal an inaccuracy in this view, and despite our Jewish calendar utilizing a slightly different year length. Nevertheless, we accept the Shmuel's length of the year for purposes of halacha. So back to our Gemara once again. Abaye explains that every 28 years, when the Tkufas Nisan, the vernal equinox, falls at the same time that it did at Briyasa Olam, namely on the evening of the fourth day of the week, that's when we say the Brahma. So let's do some of the math. The first year, let's say, of Briyasa Olam, we were told that the equinox occurred at the beginning of Yom Revi'i, which is the fourth day of the week, Wednesday, hour zero. Now, since the day begins in the evening, we will call this Tuesday 6 p.m., although it's not a precise time, but it's good enough for our purposes. So, next year, being the second year of the world, 365 and a quarter days later, the Tkufas Nisan, 52 weeks and a day and 6 hours later, so will be determined based on that simple addition. Year one, the Tkufa was day four, hour zero. We add 1 day, 6 hours. In the second year, the Tkufa will be day five, hour six. Day five, hour six is Yom Chamishi. But hour six, remember, 6 hours into the day, will be just after midnight, which is Wednesday evening at midnight. We add another 365 days, 6 hours for the next Tkufas Nisan. Once again, same calculation. It gives us from year two to determine year three, being on day six, hour 12. Day six is Friday. Hour 12 would be at the morning. Now, we don't have to go through this all one at a time. We can make a chart just doing all of this automatically. It's a very simple calculation. We just have to pay attention to the fact that since we're working with intervals of 6 hour units, so every 4 years, we end up with a full day, and therefore the time comes back to being the same hour zero. And I've highlighted this table shows from year one, year two, year three, etc. And in blue, or whatever color that is, it highlights which years will have the Tkufa falling out at the time of hour zero. And so that would be year one. And then, of course, 4 years later, year five. And then 4 years later, year nine. 4 years later, year 13. But pay attention to the fact that while the hour is the same, the day of the week is different. And the day of the week from the first year of Briyasa Olam, which was day four, you don't find occurring day four, hour zero, until you get all the way down to the bottom of the chart, when you get to year number 29, where you'll see that the Tkufas Nisan of year 29 falls on day four, which is Yom Revi'i, hour zero. So then you can just see that the cycle begins once again, and that becomes the year number 29, is the same as year one of the subsequent cycle. To determine which year of the cycle, and this cycle is referred to as the Mafzer Gadol, as Rabbi Reis pointed out, here's what you do. Take the year number, divide by 28, and the remainder that you get is the year of the cycle. For example, let's take this year, 5769 divided by 28, you get 206, remainder 1. So this is the year 1 of the 207th cycle, and it matches the first year of creation. So that's why it's this year. When during the year do we recite it? It's going to be, theoretically, on the day of the equinox. However, we're referring to a halachic equinox, not an astronomical equinox. How do you calculate the halakhic equinox? This is not at all easy if all you have is the Jewish calendar. The Rambam would give the following instructions. Just do that. That is the way the Rambam describes the method of calculating the day and time of equinox when you only have a Hebrew calendar. However, this is very easy. With a calendar that makes every year 365 and a quarter days long with almost no deviation from that. Because after all, that matches the halakhic year length. Once you know the date of the equinox one year, you know the date every year. Let's say the equinox was March 25th one year, then it will be March 25th every year. This was in fact a situation beginning from the period of the Mishnah, when the Roman Empire adopted a calendar which had exactly that year length. And exactly is a little bit of an inaccuracy. We're talking about an average year length of 365 and a quarter, but that it was never allowed to fall even as much as a full day out of step. This was known as the Julian calendar. Julius Caesar was the one who sponsored this calendar. And of course, the calendar is designed by introducing leap years every 4 years, which is just what we need for our purposes. This particular calendar was used all over the European continent for over 1,500 years. Until something big happened. Everything got thrown off in the year 1582. When the church ordered that the calendar be changed. From the Julian calendar that had always been in effect, which was great for our purposes, to what became known as the Gregorian calendar, for Pope Gregory, who ordered this change, to be more closely in step with the sun. This was designed for a relatively noble purpose. He wanted to try to make sure that the calendar remains relatively in step with the sun and not drift away, which had been happening. And so they changed the calendar. What changes were made? Two changes. First, they cut out 10 days. They just decided that from October 5th, we're not going to call tomorrow October, on October 4th, they decided we're not going to call tomorrow October 5th, we're going to call it October 15th. So they changed, they cut out 10 days. And the second significant change is that they eliminated a leap day every so often. So that each time one of those years happened, we fall an additional day out of step with them. We aren't dropping those leap days that they drop. So we can't continue to use March 25th as the date of the Tkufa. We had to convert the church's date into the Roman date on the Julian calendar, taking into account both of those adjustments. Which means that when what they called April 4th in 1609, for example. Now, I choose April 4th, 1609, because it suits my purposes. But you can make the adjustments however you want to, whichever date you care about. That date, April 4th, 1609, is what we will call March 25th, which would correspond in the Julian calendar to March 25th. What they call April 5th in 1709, because by that time we had another one of those years where they dropped a leap day and we don't. So then April 5th, we're going to call March 25th in 1709. What they call April 6th in 1809, we are still calling March 25th. Because just because they keep drifting away, but we don't, we go on metronome life every 4 years is a leap year. Now, what they called April 7th in 1909, we called March 25th. One interesting thing is what they call April 7th, 2009, we still call March 25th because, as we all remember, the year 2000 was not a year that put us an additional day out of step, because they did have we did have a leap day on 2009, And so we remain the same number of days off, and therefore April 7th, 2009 is still March 25th. Which means April 7th, 2009 is the date of the halakhic tkufas Nisan, which falls on Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. in the sense that that's the Tchilas Hayom of Yom Revi'i. But that's the night. The sun is already set then, in theory. So bright and early the next morning, in April 8th of 2009, when you have the opportunity to glance at the sun, say the Birkas Hachama. Okay, and that's it.